Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David Lotz-Leib. This week, members of the award-winning City of Tomorrow Wind Quintet will be in for a live studio performance. And with geometry on everyone's mind today, it's Pi Day, if you don't realize, 314. We'll hear about Euclid in a way not expressed by Daniel Day-Lewis in the personage of Lincoln, but as expressed in dance, as Triangulating Euclid is one of the works on the menu of the ODC Dance Downtown series. Founding artistic director Brenda Way and her co-artistic director Katie Nelson will be in to talk about their Euclidean collaboration and other dances being presented by ODC. I'll be offering tickets to the Peninsula Symphony's concerts this weekend towards the end of this hour. Plus, with St. Patrick's Day just around the corner, Peter Robinson will be here to raise the question, what does it mean to be Irish? He'll explore the idiosyncrasies of this festivity, and we'll have some music to go with it. Peter will also have a couple of movie reviews and a look ahead to summer Shakespeare. So stay with us. Flutist Robert Stallman is back in town for recitals and masterclasses. Tomorrow he performs works by Mendelssohn, Debussy, Vivaldi, and Kuhlau with flutist Isabelle Chapuis and Dimitri Kogan at the piano. Presented by the French Film Club of Palo Alto, tomorrow's concert in Tadoichi Hall in Mountain View, next Friday at Le Petit Trianon Concert Hall in San Jose with works of Fauré, Schubert, and Doppler added to the mix. You can find out information about those concerts at French Film Club of Palo Alto, all one long string on, frenchfilmclubofpaloalto.org. Robert's got a new release on the Bogner's Cafe label of the Bach sonatas with harpsichordist Edwin Swanborn. That's subtitled Evenings at Zimmerman's Coffee House, a topic we hope to delve into for a future program when we can spend some quality live time with Robert, as he paints a very different picture of old Johann Sebastian than we normally think of him, able to smoke a pipe and quaff a beer in a cafe with the best of them, instead of our image of Bach being ensconced behind a church organ. So, from Bogner's Cafe, and perhaps as heard at Zimmerman's Coffee House, here is a taste of Robert Stallman's artistry, and the third movement, Allegro, from Bach's Sonata in E-flat Major, BWV 1031. Thank you. from a release called Evenings at Zimmerman's Coffee House. That was the Allegro, the final movement of the Sonata in E-flat major, BWV 1031. You heard Robert Stallman on flute and Edwin Swanborn on harpsichord. Robert Stallman on this coast, Philadelphia area flutist, incredible musician. He's back in town for some recitals and masterclasses. More about his releases as well as the masterclasses and concerts at two sites, aboutrobertstallman.com and French Film Club of Palo Alto, all one word, .org. French Film Club of Palo Alto for those concerts tomorrow at Totoichi Hall in Mountain View and next Friday at Le Petit Trianon in San Jose. Still to come on Open Air, a live performance by members of the City of Tomorrow Wind Quintet. Peter Robinson will be talking about St. Paddy's Day, and I'll have a ticket giveaway for the Peninsula Symphony Orchestra. I'm joined in studio now by Brenda Way and Katie Nelson of ODC Dance. Brenda Way is founder and artistic director of ODC Dance and is a national spokesperson for dance. Her many awards include a Guggenheim Fellowship and being named a resident of the arts at the American Academy in Rome. Brenda, welcome to KLW. And I'm also joined by Katie Nelson, who is a co-artistic director of ODC and on the board of ODC. She's choreographed more than 54 works, as well as composing and commissioning numerous scores, and her work as a choreographer, dancer, and educator have been recognized nationally. She also is the director of ODC's Velveteen Rabbit, which has been entertaining audiences in the hundreds of thousands at this point since 1987. KT is also the director of ODC's educational outreach program, and she also joins me in studio. Hi, KT.
Hi, good morning.
First of all, you're here to talk about the ODC Dance Downtown series. Now, this is happening through March 24th down at the Lam Research Center at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. My first question is to Brenda. You've got this beautiful new facility at ODC Dance. What and how and why are we doing this down at the Lam Research Center?
Well, ironically, we built the building for the company to perform in on Chartwell, and by the time the building was built, we had outgrown it. So I immediately started to work with the Yerba Buena Development Group so that we would have a stage and a house big enough for the company, which, much to our surprise, had grown so big.
KT, I guess you've been instrumental in seeing this transformation as well.
Yes, we've started back in 1979 in the Mission District with our building on 17th Street. And as a dancer, I danced there in our theater, and I guess in 1990, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts Theater opened up, and we have been performing there ever since, both our rabbit season and our spring season.
Nice. These performances include world premieres by both of you as choreographers, commissioned music by Jay Cloyd, as well as scores by Zoe Keating, Olafur Arnolds and Ben Frost, and some original film with visual artist Barry Steele, some custom-made bicycles by Max Chen. Now, we've got to start there. As an avid bicyclist, what are these custom-made bicycles, and how do they figure into the work that KT's creating?
So they're for a piece called Transit, which is proposing an image of urban life that's wacky and chaotic but people-friendly. And given our kind of intense technological times where we can have a slow-paced walker, a bicyclist, and high-speed transit all in the same place. And I also think bicycles are just the perfect poetic image of human nature or human effort and technical design.
And these were created by a mechanical engineer and artist, Max Chen. So
yes.
Are they functional bicycles, or are they more pieces of art?
They're both.
They're both?
Yes.
All right.
He has a bench that turns into a bike. Another one is a table that's a cafe table that rolls around on the stage. And the other one, just I had him do different kinds of pacing on it so that it's just a regular bike, but it moves very slowly when you pedal it.
We won't be seeing these on Valencia Street, but they are functional bikes.
They are functional bikes. And occasionally my production manager rides them back to the storage
unit. And it may start a trend. You don't know.
So, and then I have Barry Steele, who is a filmmaker, a scenic designer, and he's created this hand-drawn film that gives us our location. The piece goes from morning, noon, night, you know, a pace of a day. And then finally, Banana Republic has joined us and partnered with us, and they are costuming the piece.
So Katie's is not entirely a new premiere, but it has many new components. So it's a new vision of her production. And the other premiere in the season is Life-Saving Maneuvers, which is a piece that I made in collaboration with composer Jay Cloyt and light and set designer Alexander Nichols. And I was thinking, of course, after this many years in a career, I've been doing this for, what, 45 years or something, Life-Saving Maneuvers seems like a good thing to think about. And I was thinking about...
Very well preserved, by the way, Brandon.
Oh, thank you so much. You're so nice. It's structured as a series of chapters investigating the things we all do to cope and survive, from sly or invisible to sensational. People are catching each other. It's really, it's this piece is developed from a series of images, and you have different ways of approaching choreography. Sometimes it's absolutely through the movement and the invention of the movement, and this one is a little bit more toward a pictorial image of things. And Jay's music is a mix of many different things, including a very raunchy version by a Mexican street band of Eleanor Rigby.
Ah, okay. So you mentioned the music. Is the music driving the choreography, or is it a combination of the choreography driving the music?
Well, for the most part, my way of working is we talk concept, the collaborators and I, and then we each go off and do something in response to that, and then we see what marries well. So that there are things that I realize, oh, this is a fantastic piece of music, so I'm going to do something different to it. And other times it works well, and other times I send him off, or her, to try to create something else to support what I've done. So it's a real conversation.
Now, you're collaborating on a work called Triangulating Euclid. Now, how are you working Euclid into the geometrics of dance, or did I answer my own question?
I think you did. No, actually, it came about because of its aesthetic beauty, actually. A friend of ours who's a conservator called me over to her studio and said, you have to see this book. It's amazing. It was published in 1482, just after Gutenberg developed his technology, and it was the first printing of Euclid. And it's a beautiful book. The texture of the paper, the Gothic print, and also the spectacular drawings of the geometry of Euclid's collection. And I just thought, what a wonderful inspiration this book was. And she had written an article called Triangulating Euclid, where she was determining the distance between the curator, the collector, and the conservator, all having a very different perspective on this book. So Katie, who had asked me if... I'd like to collaborate this season as a new method of investigating what we were thinking about. I said, yeah, but why don't we have a third person and we can triangulate Euclid?
Interesting.
So it was inspired the whole form of the work.
So triangulation in some cases can infer conflict. So I'm wondering as collaborators how that worked out with the three of you.
Well, I think one of the first things we did, Brenda and I sat down, actually, and talked about music and the overall form of the piece, understanding that we're being inspired by the restoration and content of this book. And when we decided on the form, I think that freed us to play a variety of roles. You know, most choreographers are actually choreographers, directors, and producers. So the three of us, eventually, as we started to make this work, played different those roles at different times. You know, if someone was choreographing, the other one was producing.
Music directing, or costume envisioning. I mean,
yeah.
But I think triangulating, I think of triangulating as when from the towers, when you're trying to find where a phone is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's discovering in space where an idea is located. So that's how I think of triangulating. The three of us are looking at it, but we're finding what this book is in three dimension in space.
Okay, so we talked about the visuals of the bicycle piece of
yeah.
Katie. Now, what are we going to see visually for the Euclid?
Well, the set itself is a large square of paper in the back, since we're thinking about the book and the materials of the book. And there is one section in the middle where one of our dancers creates a Euclidean form on the ground with chalk. So there's a slow visual that refers directly. But, you know, honestly, I think as with any piece, your point of departure isn't necessarily the content of the work. It's how the artist is using that material to create something on the floor.
But I do want to say that the chalk, when it gets disrupted by the movement of the dancers, shows basically, I think, what we're interested in this piece, where we start with the form, the beautiful diagrams, and end up with kind of the messy human implications.
And the piece is formed that way. It starts with sort of the formal elegance of shape and space and clarity of volume, and eventually gets more human and more messy. You may not live that way, but it resonates with us.
Just like life, believe me. So talk to me about the rest of the program.
So actually, one of the programs is the transit piece and the Triangulating Euclid. And another program is three works, starting with Cutout Guy, which is the Ben Frost music, which is a piece for Odyssey's Five Men, but this year I've added a woman in. And then we go to
Breathing Underwater, which is my piece from last year with music by Zoe Keating. And it takes the four women in the company and investigates really. I think these two pieces are companion pieces, and they really look at gender issues mm-hmm. in a sort of interesting way.
Yeah, I think for the men's piece, I was very interested in both the fierceness and fragility of men.
Hmm. How many dancers are involved in some of these other works? And you mentioned the four ladies in one.
Ten.
The
company's ten.
When
it's a company piece, there are 10 people in it.
Yes, and then the Cutout Guy and Breathing Underwater have 5 and 4 in them. So they're smaller works.
The Breathing Underwater intrigues me, with the visuals. Of course, I'm thinking of the dancers then, but I'm also thinking of what else people will see on the stage.
In Breathing Underwater, the dance takes place on a 20 by 20 foot silver floor. So there is a kind of water image there, but I was thinking about how we operate under gender stereotypes, and it is underwater, and we're not even aware of it as we breathe it in. So that was my interior logic.
The after performances next week are an LGBT night and a Meet the Dancers after party. Now, how are these special events different from what an ordinary audience member might experience?
You know, I think these days people don't want to just experience their art as a product. I think they want to take part in a more complicated way. So we have things before and after shows. That LGBT is before, where you can meet people who are interested in the arts and dance. And I think it's really about community building in every way we can these days, and made much more important by the prevalence of the internet. There are so many communities that are not physical and in person, and we're really focusing on expanding that experience of the theater, of being a social as well as aesthetic experience.
I also think when you, it's a little bit what Brenda's saying, but you come with a like-minded group of people, some you know, some you don't, it's a little more comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and there's both a chance to broaden your experience and also feel kind of grounded in your group, whether you're bicyclists or LGBT. And again, we want to build community. And Brenda and I feel strongly that we have something called balcony talks and curtain talks, and we host people in the lobby. We really want to be available to people so that the artists are people you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we don't want to explain the art, but we do want people to be in the most receptive frame of mind.
Sure.
And I think, personally, having a drink before makes me more receptive.
Staying awake might be the key, though, for some
yeah.
of this.
But I said one drink.
All right. But the fascinating choreography, I'm sure, will keep everyone alive and engaged. Well, Brenda Way, Katie Nelson, thank you so much for stopping by today. These performances will be happening through the 24th at the Lam Research Center, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Full information online at odcdance.org, including
thank you.
That's a brief sampling of the music of Zoe Keating, part of the Dancing Underwater program that you'll hear with ODC Dance. Again, information about their programs, odcdance.org. They open tonight, opening gala, special program tonight at 8, and then this weekend and the following weekend, odcdance.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You're tuned to KALW and listening to Open Air, our weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. And I'm very pleased to welcome members of the City of Tomorrow Wind Quintet to our studio next. They are the only wind quintet to win a gold medal at the prestigious Fischoff National Chamber Music Competition in 10 years' time. Two members, Elise Blatchford and horn player Leander Starr, studied here in San Francisco at the Conservatory, meeting up and forming the balance of the quintet in Chicago. And even though their name suggests a location, the City of Tomorrow, members are currently living all over the map, New York, Chicago, Portland, and San Antonio, which makes them utilize the electronic resources of today to prepare their quality time together when they do meet up in person, which includes preparation for tomorrow's concert at Old First here in San Francisco. In addition to Blatchford and Starr, the quintet includes Andrew Nogal on oboe, Camila Barrientos on clarinet, and Laura Miller bassoon. Welcome to KLW, gang.
Thank you.
Say hello.
Thank you.
We have them set up in the studio here, but Andrew is going to be talking a little bit about the quintet as he's closest to a microphone when his right hand is clutching his oboe, which we'll soon hear. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. Well, you call yourselves a retro-futurist American wind quintet. Let's have a little bit of an explanation there, shall we?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, this group took its name, The City of Tomorrow, from a poem of the same name by former American poet laureate Billy Collins. And in that poem, he nostalgically considers mid-20th century visions of the distant future. Think of the Jetsons and rocket boards and floating houses, all depicted in pastel colors and these beautiful images of possible futures. And we think that in the same way that illustrators in the 1950s imagined the future, today's composers are imagining the future of chamber music, and especially chamber music for winds, considering the ways that they might employ sounds in unusual configurations, harmonies in heretofore unimagined ways. And the music we play sometimes is antique, like the piece by Darius Milhaud that we'll play for you in a few moments. But other pieces in our repertoire very much look toward alternate futures. A piece by Magnus Lindberg called Arabesques is a consideration of computer music as the groundwork, with these beautiful floating ballet lines that gracefully float over the top of that mechanical foundation. So the music we play is both old, in the sense that it's written for old instruments and employs traditional harmonies, but also some of the pieces we play are very new, forward-thinking, avant-garde, and modern.
I understand, Andrew, you are instrumental, pun intended, I guess, for forming the quintet in Chicago. Tell us a little bit about how you first got together.
Yeah, that's right. I was a graduate student at Northwestern University, where I met Leander Starr, the horn player in the group, and we decided we wanted to play in a quintet that would investigate this often neglected repertoire, forgotten pieces, new pieces, even commissions. And Elise was living in Chicago at that time as well, and we employed her as our flute player. There was no better choice available, really. She's just a consummate musician.
Well, you could have flown me in.
Well, we were hyper-local at that point. And then we scattered to the four winds some years after that.
From the Windy City to the four winds.
That's right. So Camila and Laura have come on board in the years since we were graduate students, and they were added to the group after original members moved on to pursue other interests and other musical endeavors. But it's kind of this all-star ensemble now of musicians committed to new chamber music for winds.
Wonderful. Well, let's hear a little bit of music, and then we'll go back to talking a little bit about the quintet while they're setting up. I can tell you a little bit as they settle for their music stands. This is the City of Tomorrow Wind Quintet. They're performing tomorrow at Old First as part of the Old First Concerts series. Information at oldfirstconcerts.org. We're going to hear an excerpt from the marvelous work by Darius Milhaud, former Mills College professor, Milhaud's La Cheminée du Roi René. So here is the City of Tomorrow Wind Quintet here on KLW.
¶¶
The City of Tomorrow Quintet, which is Andrew Nogal on oboe, Camila Barrientos, clarinet, Laura Miller, bassoon, Elise Blatchford on flute, and Leander Starr on French horn for this live studio performance here on Open Air. Marvelous playing all around. Thank you so much. Really.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, indeed. A couple of fun facts about Andrew, the oboist. He's been involved with the experimental jazz collective, the Tomorrow Music Orchestra. Any relation? This theme of tomorrow seems to run through your biography.
No, that's a funny question, actually, because the founder of that group, Matthew Golombisky, is a bassist and composer who now actually lives in the Bay Area. And I think subconsciously I was fond of that project, and it may have inadvertently influenced the name of this group, but there is no real connection tangibly.
Okay. I should also mention that you worked as a production intern for the radio program Performance Today
Media. I'm so glad you've mentioned that, because it was such an important and formative experience for me as a musician. I got to listen to great classical recordings all day, 40 hours a week, and helped them to decide what got played on Performance Today, which was a marvelous experience.
Here's our 60 degrees of separation. Fred Child hired me at WNYC when I was in New York.
Oh, I love it. That's great. Fred's a wonderful
Fred,
person.
Fred, the host of Performance Today, really a marvelous human being.
Yes,
really.
He is.
So that must have been a great, great opportunity
it
for
was.
You there. You were, I should mention a little fun fact about Elise Blatchard, our flutist. She happens to be playing Tim Day's old flute. I don't know if she's playing it today, but she's played that. She has also performed on Lou Harrison's Ocarina, which would be fun to talk about at some point. She traveled to the Dominican Republic in 2009 with a group called Traveling Notes in a project supported by the U.S. Embassy and the Dominican Ministry of Culture to mentor chamber musicians in Santo Domingo. So that must have been quite an experience for you.
It was a great experience.
And speaking of that area of the world, clarinetist Camila Barrientos is Bolivian-born. She's currently freelancing in New York, and she also has an important music education curriculum vitae as being co-founder of the Ensemble Eclectico, a group dedicated to bringing classical music to the most remote audiences of Bolivia. Leander Starr is an award-winning chamber musician as a French hornist. She's performed with members of the Chicago Symphony and in concert with the Chicago Chamber Musicians, freelanced with orchestras around the country, and she holds degrees in performance from Northwestern University, as well as San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And Laura Miller, bassoonist, has soloed with the Thailand Philharmonic Orchestra, among other orchestras around the country. She also is a Baroque bassoonist, so quite a variety of experiences coming into this quintet. It's really marvelous to see. Laura, in addition to Thailand, is an award-winning bassoonist, so the quintet has got quite a nice rap sheet, shall we say.
Indeed. That's why we like to think of ourselves as an all-star ensemble.
Let me ask you, now, Andrew, you formed the ensemble. Does that make you el jefe, or are you more a democracy when it comes to decision-making?
This is a democratic ensemble. We are not strict about the administrative roles that we all play in the group, although we are solely responsible for the professional and the business operations of this business. We're actually certified as a business. I do a lot of the artistic planning, looking out for the aesthetic focus and mission of the group, but Elise handles the day-to-day business operations. A lot of the money passes through her hands, most of it does. Camila and Laura are booking tours for next season, and Leander is in charge of kind of the grunt work that no one else wants to do. That's a particular strength of his. Leander is actually a he with a pretty name, so I just wanted to clarify that.
Sure.
So, yeah, we are a democratic ensemble that makes decisions all together.
I mentioned earlier that you're kind of spread to the four compasses, or four points of the compass, in New York, Chicago, Portland, San Antonio. Now, how exactly does that work? Do you rehearse through Skype? Do you telecommute?
We haven't had to resort to Skype rehearsals yet. We've been lucky to spend a lot of time together in the past 6 months. We figured out that we've been together for 2 months, I think, of the past four or something. So
almost three months.
Yeah. So we had a residency at the Banff Center in Alberta in the early part of the winter. That was a 3 week opportunity to rehearse, build our repertoire, and do some recording. And we went on tour through the Midwest in October, and we hit I think 10 locations over the course of about as many days. Mm-hmm. And in September we had some shows together in Oregon.
You had an interesting collaboration with the Portland Cello Project for two performances of Radiohead's classic album OK Computer. Tell us how that all happened.
Well, Elise and Leander have had a relationship with Portland Cello Project for several years. They've been the de facto wind section of the Cello Project, which is a cello choir that mainly covers pop and hip-hop songs. And I got involved with them first on their hip-hop covers record. I played an oboe solo on a track by Lil Wayne called She Will on the PCP hip-hop album, which it's worth checking out because when have you ever heard cellos playing Lil Wayne, Jay-Z, Kanye?
You mean this week?
Yeah, right.
When this week, am I?
Count on just two hands, yeah. So when the Portland Cello Project had this big idea of doing two Radiohead shows, they wanted the whole quintet to come out and help them out. So we booked our rehearsal residency this fall in Portland around the dates of those Radiohead shows.
Very nice.
It was great.
Well, the Fischhoff Prize, I'm sure, has added a degree of gravitas to your collective resume. And I imagine it's important to include when you're pursuing some fundraising. Now, there are a gazillion string quartets out there making the rounds. Now, how are you finding funding for a woodwind quintet and making that pitch?
Well, I think a lot of presenters are curious about us because the wind repertoire is much less familiar than the repertoire that is so familiar that the string quartets are able to play Beethoven, Bach, or Beethoven, Brahms, Bartok. So I think there's curiosity about us, for sure, because we're doing something slightly different from the norm. And the Fischhoff name certainly has been helpful to us in just automatically giving us credibility. And I think there are many, many great musicians today making their livings the way we are, with self-managed ensembles and creative missions. But we've been lucky, and we're really grateful to Fischhoff for giving us that stamp of approval, and to so many presenters for taking a chance on us and letting us do what we do, which is to play 20th and 21st century music at a really high level.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the concert tomorrow evening, and then we'll hear some more music.
Well, tomorrow evening we'll be playing the full Mio, La Cheminée du Roi René, which is a seven-movement suite based on medieval themes, although it doesn't actually use medieval harmonies. They're all very 20th century in style. And we're playing a piece by Magnus Lindberg, which I already mentioned, Arabesques, which is this kind of ballet of decay, of cyclical harmonies and little cells of melodic material that get repeated over and over again. We're doing a piece by Luciano Berio, the very influential and famous composition teacher and innovator. That piece, Ricorrenze, is this 17-minute exploration of these quite simple melodies, actually, that get fractured and manipulated in fascinating ways, and the whole group is kind of stuttering, trying to get their version of the melody out. And the final piece on the program is by my friend Rob Keeley, who is an English composer working at King's College London. And Rob wrote this wind quintet in 2011, and we gave it its world premiere in Edmonton, Alberta, last December. And now this will actually be its U.S. premiere tomorrow night.
Fantastic. Well, let's get you settled over at your oboe chair, and we'll hear a little bit of the Rob Keeley wind quintet, which was written in 2003 and I guess added to in 2011. Rob was born in 1960. And we're going to hear the City of Tomorrow wind quintet now in an excerpt from Rob Keeley's wind quintet, which will be heard tomorrow evening at Old First Concerts. It's an excerpt from Rob Keeley's Wind Quintet. Rob, born in 1960, having this work debuted tomorrow evening at the Old First Concerts with the City of Tomorrow Quintet. City of Tomorrow Quintet is Andrew Nogle on oboe, Camila Barrientos clarinet, Laura Miller on bassoon, Elise Blatchford on flute. Did I leave anyone out? I don't think I did. No, that's everybody.
Leander Starr on horn.
Oh, yes, of course, Leander Starr on horn. How could we forget Leander, one of our San Francisco folks? Well, I thank you so much for taking a little time today. I hope you have a wonderful concert tomorrow, and we look forward to the next round of concerts wherever in the world
Thanks
that you
very much
decide
for
to come.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm joined now once again by Peter Robinson to talk a little bit about St. Patrick's Day and the music thereof, as well as a little the idiosyncrasies of St. Paddy's Day. Hey, Peter.
Hi, good to be here, David. And this time a little different sort of wind, a cool wind blowing across the Irish Sea. And what I thought I'd begin with was a piece of music which in many ways conjures up all those images of Ireland, and then I'll deal with some of the myths. So here's a song called The Rising of the Moon, which in fact is an older song going back to the Wearing of the Green. And you'll hear the pipes coming through loud and clear.
Oh, come tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush me vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, make all ready quick and soon. For the pipes must be together by the rising of the moon.
by the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. Well, the pipes must be together by the rising of the moon.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the Allspot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon.
By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon.
Out of many a mud wall cabin, eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly heart was throbbing for that coming morning light. Rumors ran along the valleys like the banshee's lonely groan. And a thousand lights were flashing by the rising of the moon.
By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. And a thousand pikes were flashing by the rising of the moon. All along the singing river, the dark mass of men was seen. Out of all the shining weapons on their own beloved green. Dead to every foe and traitor, forward strikes the marching tune. And an army boys for freedom, tis the rising of the moon. Tis the rising of the moon. The rising of the moon, and an army voice for freedom, is the rising of the moon.
Classic Clancy Brothers with Robbie O'Connell and the Rising of the Moon. Peter Robinson here to explain a little bit more about the holiday that is coming up. Grab a green beer and sit down at the pub.
You got it right. But also, let's first dispel some of the great myths that surround what we call St. Paddy's Day or St. Patrick's Day.
Including green beer.
Including green beer. And also the fact that St. Patrick himself was actually born in Britain at the turn of the 4th century. And at 16, Irish raiders captured him in the midst of an attack on his family estate and took him to Ireland, and he was held captive for 6 years. He then managed to escape back to England. He had religious training and became a priest, and many years later went back to Ireland as a missionary. So there we have the Irish St. Patrick, who was actually born in Britain. His original name was Mawen Sukat, which according to the legend he changed to Patricius, which is the Latin for Patrick, and in its original form actually means father figure. When he became a priest, he adopted the shamrock as a symbol for Christianity, and this indeed was interesting because it represented for him the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, but it was actually born of a single stem. And unlike American Pie, they didn't take the last train to the coast.
Yes.
But they did end up in Ireland. Now, the song we've been listening to, known as The Rising of the Moon, also has the other title, The Wearing of the Green. It's an Irish street ballad that actually goes back to the Irish Rebellion of 1789. And there are many different versions of this lyric. But I think the key line in the song, the hanging men and women for the wearing of the green, is in fact the story of the revolutionary society of United Irishmen who adopted green as the colour and could be prosecuted for sedition held by the administration at Dublin Castle during the British occupation. So the song indeed has an emotive feel to it, which has carried on through the centuries. And you may have heard the pipes playing in the background. Well, the Irish gave the pipes to the Scots as a joke, but the Scots haven't seen the joke yet. And what they say is there's nothing more beautiful than a distant piper on a distant hill.
Well, you know, I think there's...
And the more distant hill, the more distant the hill, the more beautiful the piper.
I think there are as many bagpipes jokes as there are viola jokes. For instance, the Scotsman that left his bagpipes in the back of his car ran back and because he forgot that he didn't lock the car and it was too late. Someone had already thrown another set of bagpipes in the back seat.
Well, there you go. I mean, I think what they say, a gentleman is somebody who knows how to play the bagpipes but doesn't.
Yes, I have heard that.
Now, there are a couple of other myths about the Irish, which I think we will try to dispel. And that is that an Irishman doesn't know what he believes in, but he'll fight to the death to get it. And I think that's one of the ones which I think needs careful consideration. The Irish playwright James Goldsmith defined a true Irishman who has so much respect for the truth that he only uses it in emergencies. Now, in my case, I was at an Irish celebration the other evening, and I think we all know Ireland is indeed a country of poets. So I thought I'd give five lines of poetry, which I take back to the month of November. It's a little earlier than St. Patrick's Day, but it did ring a chord with me. 'Twas an evening in November that I very well remember. I was walking down the street with drunken pride, but my knees went all aflutter, and I ended in a gutter, and a pig came up and sat down by my side. As I lay there in the gutter, thinking thoughts I could not utter, a colleen walking by was heard to say, "You can tell a man who boozes by the company he chooses," and the pig got up and politely walked away.
Very nice, I have heard that.
So I offer that as a cautionary tale, and this cautionary tale is leading into another song, and it's a song indeed about the Irishman who actually ended up in the wrong pub at the wrong time, at the wrong moment. And what was it that he discovered? Well, he discovered the pub had no beer.
More from the Clancy Brothers.
Well, it's lonesome away from your kindred and all, by the campfire at night where the wild dingoes call. But there's nothing so lonesome, so awful or dream, than to stand in the bar of the pub with no beer. And the barman's awaiting the beer for to come. There's that faraway look on the face of the bar. The barmaid's gone crazy, the cook's acting queer. What a terrible place is the pub with no beer. Well, it's lonesome away from your kindred and all, by the campfire at night where the wild dingoes call. Well, there's nothing so lonesome, so morbid or drear, than to stand in the bar of the pub with no beer. A stockman rides up.
Well, a long way from a pub with no beer, we're now back to movies here in San Francisco. And I've seen two very different but interesting films, both reflecting on turning points in the past. And the first is simply has the title Emperor. The Emperor, in fact, refers to the Japanese Emperor Hirohito, and it deals with a person who may easily have become an emperor had he not been stopped in his tracks, General MacArthur. MacArthur is played by Tommy Lee Jones, and I think this, again, is an example of movie makers choosing just the right person for the right part. The story deals immediately with the post-World War II period. We're actually in 1945, and the Americans have now moved into Japan after the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and they are setting up a commission to see who was to blame for the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So it's an interesting, almost post-World War II story, and it has, as a subtext, a kind of love element. The second major role, that of General Bonner Fellows, is played by Matthew Fox. And in the story, he had had an affair back in 1938, 1939, before war began, with a Japanese school teacher. He'd been out to Tokyo and clearly understands Japanese culture. Now, I'm in a different position to many of the crits. I thought the love story was there. It didn't ruin the film for me. A lot of people have been distracted by some of the slow-motion shots in the love story. But I think the essence of how to make a decision as to whom is a war criminal and who is not, and how that kind of grey area, it's a moral grey land where both right and wrong operate on two sides of the fence, and was the emperor more valuable to help bring a new sense of future and democracy to Japan, and what was the role that General MacArthur played? I think all those elements are brought to life in this movie. I would certainly recommend it, as we live in times where the war tribunals in The Hague are still making difficult decisions today, and when, in fact, you're an occupying force, you do need, to a large extent, the occupiers and the occupiees to be working together in harmony. My second movie, The Gatekeepers, has also raised many provocative questions. This is a documentary. It's a documentary with subtitles. You will need your spectacles with you to make sure you can keep up with the text. And it tells the story of the anti-terrorist movement in Japan and how real-life people who were involved in the intelligence gathering dealt with counter-terrorism. It is provocative because the film certainly reaches a conclusion, and the conclusion it reaches is that the current occupation of Palestine as we know it was probably not the best decision. So if you want a good documentary, a piece of history, and a contrasting different type of history, two movies running currently in the city and in the Bay Area. The first is Emperor, the story of the occupation of Japan by General MacArthur, and the second is The Gatekeepers, a story about how Israeli intelligence dealt with counterterrorism.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. As always, not only to recommend some movies, but giving that very insightful information about the St. Patrick's holiday.
Good to be here on the top of the morning to everybody, even though it's coming up for lunchtime.
Sure, and if it isn't lunchtime, it's past already. Okay. Well, Peter, indeed.
Happy trails.
All of that, yes. We'll save our summer Shakespeare prelude for another visit. Let's do that, shall we? Also, on the local side happening here in San Francisco Bay Area, the Peninsula Symphony will be continuing its concert series this weekend, featuring Brahms' First Symphony and Hindemith's brilliant March as anchors to a program which includes the debut performance of 17-year-old cellist Austin Huntington, another stunning winner of the Irving M. Kline International Competition. The pre-concert lecture by longtime horn player of the symphony, Brian Holmes, who is also a professor of music physics at San Jose State University, will include an alp horn performance based on a postcard from Brahms to Clara Schumann. That's at 7 p.m. The 8 p.m. concert on Friday is at the Fox Theater at 8, and Saturday at the Flint Center at De Anza College. As we listen to a touch of some Dvorak from the Dvorak Cello Concerto, we will hear Austin Huntington perform with the Peninsula Symphony. I'm pleased to offer some single or pairs of tickets to the first six callers who reach us here at our studio line, 415-841-4134. Tickets to the Peninsula Symphony either Friday in Redwood City or Saturday at De Anza College in Cupertino. This is not Austin performing the Dvorak Cello Concerto, but Alban Gerhard with BBC Philharmonic under Naomi Arvey. 415-841-4134 if you'd like tickets to the Peninsula Symphony. Bon Gerhardt with the BBC Philharmonic. You can hear Austin Huntington perform that with the Peninsula Symphony this weekend. PeninsulaSymphony.org for more information.